the basic knowledge about the world from
So we're talking about points of reference, and part of why I'm so delighted with our closing speaker tonight is she brings a different point of reference than most of us. So most of us spend our lives in the academic and educational world, and the world of government is actually a very different one, and so it's so valuable to hear that point of view. In 1992, then Secretary Baker said there was only one way, one proper way to introduce the President of the United States, and that is, ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States. Ladies and gentlemen, Maureen O'Neill, President of Canada's International Development and Research Centre.
Thank you very much, Dr. Brewer. I think we practically do need to take another stretch as we were, but I won't make you do it now. I'm delighted to be able to join in this conversation at the end of the afternoon. As scholars, scientists, and practitioners, you are concerned with addressing, and Duncan Peterson really gave me a good lead-in for this, you're addressing one of the most lethal and unnecessary injustices of our age, the inequalities of health and health care suffered by the poorest and most vulnerable people on Earth. And you've brought an extraordinary diversity of perspectives and experience to this meeting, and I'm really happy to be with you. Je débuterai par une question. Comment la recherche peut-elle aider à réduire les écarts considérables en matière de bien-être et services de santé qui sont si évidents à l'échelle de la planète? What can research contribute to correcting these grave disparities in well-being and in access to services, disparities that are so evident across the world? This is a variant of the question that has defined the purpose and work of my own organization, the International Development Research Center. IDRC was created by the Canadian Parliament in 1970 with a single enduring mandate, and that is to foster research in developing regions of the world, and the Act was very specific about that, but research that was to be done by the people, the researchers, the scientists from those countries. It was only, in a sense, by the way, that Canadians were to be engaged in that work. And so, for the last now almost 40 years, IDRC has been in that business. It's been in the business of supporting thinking, arguing, and acting. Il faut cependant reconnaître qu'après toutes ces années, la recherche en santé mondiale demeure beaucoup trop axée sur les priorités et les préoccupations commerciales des économies des pays riches. Alors, environ 90% de toutes les revues spécialisées en santé sont publiées dans une vingtaine de pays seulement. De plus, seule une infime fraction des articles publiés par les chercheurs en santé dans des revues à comité de lecture portent sur les besoins en santé les plus pressants des pays en développement. These numbers reflect a chronic misallocation of healthcare funding and health research funding on a global scale. But the numbers also argue for a clear-eyed focus on devising and executing research that has real effect on the lives of people afflicted by these continuing disparities. Experience points to three imperatives for conducting and putting to good use health research that matters. The first imperative for researchers is to start by assembling a rigorous practical understanding of the actual needs of poor people. And this means talking to people in their households, in their villages, in their neighborhoods. And it means engaging policymakers and health system administrators to help in assessing people's needs and problems. The second research imperative, no less important, is to make some hard-nosed and imaginative judgments about which problems are actually amenable to research-based solutions. Because we're not looking just for answers, we're looking for answers that actually can lead to improvements. And in the realm of delivering better health care in poor regions, this is seldom accomplished by any quick fix of technology or apparatus, no matter how sophisticated. In the fascinating presentation by Dr. Carley, there was a need for a team to maintain the machines. There was a need for a very informed group, a very informed organization to keep things ticking over. Lasting health care improvements nearly always involve better governance, better policy, better management. And that brings me to the third research imperative. For research to have lasting effect, researchers have to recognize in their own work the central importance of transforming research findings into public policy and practical action. Decades of supporting research by IDRC has certainly established this point. To improve lives, especially the lives of poor and otherwise disadvantaged people, health research, and indeed almost any kind of research, needs to influence policy. I can't emphasize that enough. The consequent imperative is inescapable. Health researchers must embed policy considerations and the practicalities of implementation into their research projects from the beginning to the end. And I'm not just talking about Canadian researchers, I'm talking about the researchers who are working in developing countries, even though we're not supposed to call them that. Admittedly, thinking politically doesn't often or always come naturally to researchers. The compromises of politics, the confusions of policymaking, because nothing ever happens in a straight line, can baffle and repel scholars and scientists in any discipline. But hard experience and some pioneering research on the research that IDRC has supported has shown that research for policy influence is both necessary and indeed possible. More than that, we now have the evidence to show that certain approaches to doing research can greatly enhance the chances of getting new knowledge into policy and practice. And in health research, getting a new discovery into policy and practice is just as important as the discovery itself. Now, I was going to give you only one example, but because Hans Rosling talked about the decline in child mortality in Tanzania, I'm going to add another one. Because I do think that there's a relationship, a happy relationship, between work that the Tanzanian Ministry of Health carried out over a period, a very targeted work over a period of about a decade, assisted by Canada through IDRC, has been central to that decline in child mortality. And this was the Tanzania Essential Intervention Project. And I won't go into its details, just to say that it began in its whole central idea was testing the hypotheses that were in the 1993 World Development Report about the essential interventions that could make significant positive differences in people's health. And Tanzania decided that they would test this in real time. And I won't go, you can look it up on our website. But what happened was, in the first two districts, over a period of 8 years, children's mortality dropped by about 40%, aided by a whole variety of things. But a big help in it was indeed the use of insecticide-treated bed nets, which, you know, now Sharon Stone is promoting. I mean, so what began as an idea originally, and indeed the insecticide-treated bed nets everyone now claims credit for, but I have to tell you, about 25 years ago, IDRC supported the first research that was done on that. In any case, here was Very targeted, very practical research done by Ministry of Health looking for ways to increase and use much better information about the people in villages, about what they were actually sick with, and then developing what they were making available in terms of services to relate to that. And I'm sure that that is one of the reasons why Tanzania, because they then generalized this across the country, an improved management system, an improved information system, and a better approach, and that's why children's mortality is decreasing. I also want to talk about a research project in South Africa. This is a multi-year project known by the acronym PULSA, for Practical Approaches to Lung Health in South Africa. As in many countries, respiratory diseases are common in South Africa and impose a severe burden on an underfinanced health system. Diagnosis and treatment often rest with nurses whose training too often is insufficient, but whose value to their community health, to their communities, and to the health of people in them is enormous. PULSA, based at the University of Cape Town, originated as an in-service training program for nurse practitioners, but with a crucial research component aimed at identifying impediments to effective care and designing fast, affordable remedies to overcome these impediments. Pretty quickly, PULSA was devising computer-based methods for tracking patients and patient health, and it wasn't long before provincial authorities in the Free State approached project managers to expand PULSA to include the introduction of antiretrovirals. Eventually, and overcoming considerable resistance in the policy community, South Africa's National Health Department enlisted PULSA, by then known as PULSA Plus due to improvements, to help with the South Africa-wide ART program. But getting research into policy took time. The National Health Department only approached PULSA some 5 years after research started in the Free State, although I did point out to colleagues in South Africa that getting an idea from research into policy in Canada in 5 years would be viewed as a kind of, a miracle. Early results in the research were striking, especially in the nurses' diagnostic skills. Detection of TB by PULSA-trained nurses rose by 68%. The number of TB patients who then volunteered for HIV testing more than doubled. And health administrators were tracking patients much more consistently. So here was health research with real influence, unexpected influence when you consider those political and official sensitivities in South Africa against any frank acknowledgement of HIV/AIDS. Moreover, PULSA's successes can be attributed to straightforward strategies available to other researchers in other places, strategies that can strengthen their prospects for influencing policy and practical action. And I'll cite five of these. First, the researchers carried out meticulous needs assessments, assembling an understanding at ground level of the existing health system's deficiencies and failures. Second, the PULSA people engaged local and provincial health officials in the earliest stages of their research. So the people on the ground, the administrators of the provincial health systems, were partners from the beginning in the research. And the PULSA researchers listened very attentively to how policymakers and administrators related their own problems in the system. And they drew members of the policy community into the design of evidence-based solutions. Third, as research results emerged in stages, researchers created various fora in which they and policymakers collaborated in jointly reviewing the research findings and deciding next steps together. Training of nurses improved, patient outcomes improved, information analysis and communication improved, and scarce resources were better spent. As these results accumulated, diverse political, bureaucratic, and professional interests converged and a shared vision developed. Fourth, PULSA put together a very adroit media strategy. And as I have said, and as everybody in this room knows, by the late 1990s, the South African authorities had a very bad reputation for dismissing the realities of HIV/AIDS. But their reputation, in fact, had energized a vigorous mass media coverage of the subject in South Africa itself. And, of course, the non-government or non-governmental organizations were primordial in pushing forward their views. So reporters and editors were receptive to any fresh evidence that action against HIV/AIDS and related illnesses was not only possible, but already underway. PULSA systematically deployed media interest to advance PULSA's progress. And fifth, PULSA managers sought and found one or two officials in the National Department of Health who were open to the evidence and inclined to act. As in any bureaucracy, there's great heterogeneity. Certainly everybody doesn't think the same, so identifying those who were sympathetic was crucial. These officials were involved early in conferences and other activities, and this gave these officials timely and useful knowledge, and they gave PULSA early currency in the policy community. So even in a resistant bureaucracy, researchers can sometimes find early adopters and advocates, friendly policy advisors and managers who can join a research endeavor and promote discoveries into policy. I've described these strategies as methods that researchers can apply in order to influence policy in action. And in our own wide-ranging evaluation of research for policy influence in many different political and economic settings confirms the effectiveness in these strategies. What success requires, however, is that researchers consider and plan for policy implications from the earliest design phases of their research projects. Researchers need to ask systematically and repeatedly, what level of government has the authority or incentive to act on this research evidence? Who among officials or politicians might become advocates for implementation? What is the convincing economic argument for implementation? And economic necessity is always compelling in these matters. And how can media mobilize public and political opinion in favor of implementation? Quite often, in short, the science that's needed most to get research into policy is political science, the disciplined analysis of policy and politics. But the approaches that have shaped PULSA and other influential research go beyond the reform of particular policy. The more expansive significance of these cases is simply this: research done right can fortify the elements of democratic governance. By strengthening a country's capacity for discovering, sharing, and using knowledge, research like this helps to push governments to become more open, responsible, and effective. And there is no more powerful research in this respect than health research. Equitable health reforms grounded in the solid evidence of research can create a more cohesive society, extending not only the rights of citizenship, but the boundaries of democracy itself. Because democracies must deliver for their people. Research encourages open inquiry and debate. It empowers people with the knowledge to hold governments accountable, and it enlarges the array of policy choices available to citizens and to their governments. Early in my remarks, I referred to the global inequalities of health and healthcare as unnecessary. As many of you know well, the inadequacies of healthcare available to poor people in almost any country are usually rooted more in failures of governments than in a lack of resources. Even in poor countries, the health of vulnerable people is harmed less by scarcity of money in the economy than by unjust and ill-informed policy choices. So this is probably the best contribution that research can make to the health of most people in developing countries. Research to inform and encourage transparent, tolerant, accountable, and effective governance. thank you very much. I salute your contributions to this great purpose, and I look forward to hearing from all of you as the years go by what the Canadian students are learning when they have opportunities to serve overseas. I've enjoyed very much being with you today. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So we're at the end of what I hope has been a very educational day. I recognize it's been a somewhat long day, and I'll take just a couple of minutes to pull together some themes that I think I've gleaned through the many wonderful presentations that we've had today. The first is knowledge, and it started off with Professor Rosling challenging us to understand what is it that we really know. And do we know what we believe we know? We heard that kind of percolate all through the day, whether it's learning from others, as Dr. Walker talked about, or really understanding the ethical frameworks that we use when we bring to bear in a situation, to the final presentation by Ms. O'Neill, where she talks about how needs assessments form the basis of really driving a successful program. That knowledge needs to be there. The second is communication. And so that came up in a number of different ways. And as we kind of learned about, I didn't know about that program. And so when we're hearing about the University of Toronto from Catherine Rouleau, and she's talking about their new residency and fellowship program and saying, look, you know, here's my email, send me an email and let's start talking to each other. When one of the students, Vivian Carley, said, well, how does this apply to non-healthcare related individuals who are interested in global health, whether it's talking about what we learn from our colleagues overseas, we have to be talking to each other and we have to really begin to do more communicating than I think we have. I think the third thing that I took away is faculty. And if you notice, not all of the faculty were faculty, right? And so I think it opens up that who we can learn from and what we need to learn. We need to be open about that. The next thing that I took from that was partnerships, and I think both Professor Carley and Francois gave beautiful examples of partnerships and how critical that is. And I think the word that he slipped in there very quietly, but in my roughly 20, 25 years of working overseas, is so critically important is trust. And I think trust is really fundamental to moving a lot of this forward. The next is motivation. Why do we do what we do? And do we really, really understand that? The one after that was research and action. And really, how do we move beyond just talking about some of these important issues to actually make some changes? For those of you who are going to the AFMC meeting, we will have our resource group on global health meeting tomorrow at 1 o'clock. It's going to focus specifically on pre-departure training, and hopefully we'll see some of you there. So I hope that you've had a chance to, I'm going to borrow from Catherine. I hope you had a chance to think some today. I hope you have the opportunity to argue tonight over dinner, and that tomorrow and in the future you will act. And thank you very much for joining us.